And welcome everybody on YouTube. Here we are. Kyle, did you make it over?
Sure.
And Rob T. Firefly, are you there?
I am right here.
And I don't see Gila, but I assume she's somewhere.
She stepped briefly away. She'll be right back.
Okay, and Alex, are you there?
I am here.
Great, okay. Well, you know, a million people are going to ask us what that was. It was Negative Land. I know it's one of my favorite tracks of all time, Time Zones. I could listen to that all day. In fact, I have listened to that all day. That's why I played it tonight, because I couldn't stop listening to it. There's a whole thing with Radio Moscow calling an operator from the 1980s, and just all kinds of incredible things.
Yeah, great audio soundscape and collage. So Hope people enjoyed that. Phone line is open.
Well, let's not open the phone line quite yet because
we should close it.
We want to. Well, let's have a little bit of a conversation because we were talking about Google and rewriting the rules on passwords. There was this whole story about iPhones and how people are losing their lives because their iPhones get compromised. Has anyone heard about this? Alex, you have an iPhone, right?
I do, yes. I haven't heard about this story, though. Is this a story you're going to enlighten us about?
Well, I mean, I can. I would hope that iPhone users have heard about this because apparently they're in great danger and must be warned about this. I'll read you the opening paragraphs of this story that was on CNN. It's a complex but concerning method of gaining control over a user's iPhone and permanently locking them out of the device. So now, some iPhone thieves are exploiting a security setting called the recovery key. Do you have a recovery key, Alex?
I do indeed.
All right. What is that recovery key?
Hold on. Let me read it to you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right.
Rob, stop laughing. It's not funny. I'm not hearing anything, Alex. You're muted.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't have it handy at the moment. Maybe next week I'll read everybody my recovery key.
All right. Well, I was testing you, and you sort of passed the test. Don't give out your recovery key. Don't give out your recovery. Not when we're on the air. Give it to me later.
That's good advice.
No, give it to me when we're off the air, and we'll take it from there. But the recovery key makes it nearly impossible for owners to access their photos, messages, data, and more. That's according to a recent Wall Street Journal report. Some victims also told the publication their bank accounts were drained after the thieves gained access to their financial apps. And, you know, I think the thing here is that it's all tied together. You put everything on your phone, give your phone access to everything that's important, and then you lose access to your phone, you lose access to everything that's important. Now, this type of takeover is rather hard to pull off. It requires a criminal, and thank you, CNN, for saying criminal, not a hacker, because it does require a criminal. Basically watching an iPhone user enter the device's passcode by looking over their shoulder in a bar or at a sporting event or really anywhere where there's a shoulder and you can look over it.
On camera.
That too. Yeah, you could record people.
Surveillance.
That's how you get passwords at ATMs, you know. Well, yeah, but that's a different story. Manipulating the device's owner so they'll share their passcode. You know, like Rob, you were telling me once about the passcode you had that was like so funny. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
What was that again?
I think I've forgotten it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Okay. You guys are good. I got to say, you've been trained well. So yeah, get the passcode, and then that you have to steal the device on top of that. So obviously you have to get the passcode, then get the phone, then enter the passcode. And then use it to change the device's Apple ID, turn off Find My iPhone so their location cannot be tracked, and then reset the recovery key, which Alex has still not given me. That's a complex 28-digit code intended to protect its owners from online hackers. Is yours 28 digits, Alex?
I would presume it is. I haven't looked at this in a really long time, but yeah. Probably.
Well, Apple requires this key to help reset or regain access to an Apple ID in an effort to bolster the user's security. But if a thief changes it, and again, CNN, thank you for saying thief, the original owner will not have the new code and will be locked out of the account. And that could only be the beginning of your problems because, if they're in the account and you can't get into the account, they can do all kinds of things in your name. and maybe lock you out of other accounts as well. An Apple spokesperson said in a statement to CNN, "We sympathize with people who have had this experience, and we take all attacks on our users very seriously, no matter how rare. We work tirelessly every day to protect our users' accounts and data and are always investigating additional protections against emerging threats like this one." But on its website, Apple warns you're responsible for maintaining access to your trusted devices and your recovery key. If you lose both of these items, you could be locked out of your account permanently. What you can do is you can protect your passcode, or, as Apple is suggesting, and this might sound kind of familiar, you can use Face ID or Touch ID when unlocking your phone in public to avoid revealing your passcode to anyone who might be watching. So this is basically the same thing Google is saying. Stop using passwords. Use your face instead. Use your finger instead, because criminals, thieves, can't get a hold of those things, at least not without you noticing.
That's all nice and everything, but, you know, always, eventually, Apple or iPhones will require you to utilize your actual passcode to open up the phone. You know, after a certain number of logins, I think using biometric methods, or if there's been some kind of unusual activity, they're still forcing you to do it. Or, you know, let's say you have a mask on and you can't unlock your phone because you have a mask on your face. I mean, even though I know people will call in or write in and say, "Oh, well, Apple introduced some feature that now allows you to unlock your phone while you're having a mask on," but not everybody has set that up. And quite frankly, that was introduced so late into the pandemic that it, I think, really didn't have a lot of utility. But you still need a passcode anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the day will ever come where people aren't using passwords or passcodes?
Yeah, I do. I think that they'll be used in far fewer instances in the future. But I don't think that we have cracked that nut just yet, because of this notion of identity belonging not to the individuals, but to corporations who manage this system of identity and this process of authentication for us on the internet. I think when we control our own identities and authentication systems ourselves, then I think we will have more autonomy and less reliance on things like passcodes and recovery keys and things like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's interesting. There's all these different phrases, passwords, passphrases, passcodes, and what Google is calling passkeys. I mean, it's all kind of confusing to, I think, the average user. Like, passkey, passcode, password, what's the difference?
I have a theory.
Go ahead.
That passcode or passkey might be something they're trying to get into vogue to get people to stop using words like mm-hmm. password.
Uh-huh.
You know, so to let people know it doesn't have to necessarily be a dictionary word. Could be anything.
Like a sentence.
Especially like a sentence, right, or the initial letters of a sentence.
Well, that's a passphrase. That's a passphrase, a sentence. So I don't know what the difference between a passkey and a password is. It's just, well, I think a key is something that's generated, whereas a word is something you come up with, right?
And a phrase is
a sentence. Yeah, it's longer.
I think those are good, simple ways to at least try to compartmentalize or categorize it, or ways of thinking about it. So.
Anyway, they suggest that you back up your phone, your iPhone, regularly via iCloud or iTunes. Now, okay, fine, Apple. Of course, you're going to say back up your phone to us, but is there a way to back up an iPhone to something else? Let's say you don't want Apple having your data. Let's say you want it to be someplace maybe you control, or maybe some other company controls. Is that possible? Alex, can you back up your phone to a non-Apple service?
I think you can. Well, it would be in a format, I think, that only Apple could. Well, if you use the Apple backup system, then you can back it up locally, but you're still backing it up in a format, I think, that's only readable to Apple itself. But there are ways that you can access the data on your phone and copy it to some local system, and then copy it to some third-party system, you know, whereby you're not using Apple's backup procedures. That's quite possible. But to back up the entirety of the phone to a separate place whereby it could just be restored onto a new device. I think you have to use Apple for that. I could be wrong, but I don't think you can get around.
But it's your phone. Shouldn't you have the ability to do what you wish with your data on your phone and back it up to whatever service you want?
Well, I think that's an open question here, because, you know, backing up is a process that they could consider to be proprietary in one way or another, based on their file formats, the system, the way in which the operating system interacts with the device, that kind of thing. But you can get all the data off of your phone, but just not in a way that makes it incredibly easy to replace that data on a new device.
Go ahead, Cal.
It's certainly the portability of their operating system and what you've agreed ostensibly to license or be a user of is going to work on other systems or in an outside way at your own peril. I mean, there's their obligation to make their backups as widely portable and exportable as possible is very minimal. I mean, they have the expectation that you might use more of their services to protect it, but to exfiltrate it, it's the more you think about it, it's the antithesis of protecting a device or locking it down, as it were, however you want to put it. The more exportable it is, the easier it is to exfiltrate people's data. And that's exactly what you're trying to avoid in so far as protecting users and providing a service. Having the service providers trust the hardware is going to work on their service for their customers in a reliable, safe way.
Well, the point that I think we're slowly arriving at is that we want to believe we own our devices. We want to believe we own our data, but that's conditional at best. And at worst, we don't own anything. We're just leasing time on a device, and it could all go away on a whim. You know, it's something that we're seeing frequently.
I think because of the capabilities of these devices, we really, and what I'm hearing here, and barring some future development or something that has really easy uptake or that's just super invasive, like implanted or some sort of hardware, software key that's, you know, maybe somewhat biometric. I don't know, like based on, you know, your unique vibes, you know, whatever security crystals they issue people, you know, until then, we're going to be working in an environment where we need to treat these highly capable general computers that are running a very proprietary, limited user interface and operating system to work with baseband and communicate with the towers and the service provider. Yeah, I mean, you know, let's just treat it like it's a phone. Like, the less reliant you are on this convenience factor, which all of these things really are, banking apps, yeah, convenient to have it, but is it less convenient than it ruining your life and draining your bank accounts?
Exactly. Yeah.
Your ex-spouse or your, you know, domestic or other, you know, exposures of your device being out there just add that much more trouble if that device is a point of failure in your overall personal security. So I just think like that until that little, you know, magical idealized security scheme is realized in a way that's actually got uptake and people like are like, yeah, this makes sense, I can do this, you're gonna get this wordy pitching and we'll at least back it up when it fails, because they don't have a lot of high confidence or this idealized mechanism in place yet, or even in the pipe, so to speak. So you should just behave as though this ought not be a single point of failure, because they also make things like cloning, like having a backup phone, very impossible because of the way they issue identity on the network and issue hardened security in the handsets themselves and how they issue them to customers. So it gets increasing the more complex they make it. It's just creating a more enticing target, because so many people will then trust Apple inherently because of their security prowess, or Google, because again, they've hyped up all these other little resilience features that are supposed to make you more comfortable being your true self on their platform or divulging or otherwise linking all these really, you know, crucial things like personal finance and so forth.
I think people need to ask themselves the question, what would happen if I lost my phone? How much would my life be destroyed? Will you lose all your pictures? Will you lose all your communications? Will you lose access to vital accounts or apps or things like that? Assume that you're going to lose your phone, or that your phone will be stolen, or maybe it will just blow up. You know, anything is possible. Do you have a plan? Do you have a way of copying your data, having it available someplace else that you control? Because yeah, it's all fine and good to back up to these services, but hey, these services go away too. We've seen it countless times where all of a sudden they're just they're sunsetting. That's a nice way of saying it. They're sunsetting a certain service, and you're screwed. You know, you don't have access, and if you're not paying attention and you miss it, your data's gone. You need to have control over that. If it's something you really trust and you know that it's going to be around, then by all means go for that. But ideally, having your data locally, having your pictures on a device you can control, you know, physically, that is the best solution, I think. And I don't think enough people do that. So I can say, you know, I could lose my phone tomorrow. It'd be a pain in the ass. I'd have to get another phone. But I'm not going to lose pictures. I'm not going to lose conversations. I'm not going to lose, you know, anything that is really going to be that much of a concern. I don't do banking from my phone. I think that would be crazy. You know, it's a device. You just treat it as a convenience and not as your life.
I would just add just creative ideas, you know, break up where you put different things. You know, there are a myriad of ways to save, like you said, periodically files from the SD cards, like photos, things that are important that you want a backup of anyway, contact lists, maybe, you know, print that or copy it down somewhere, or have a little address book that you keep in a junk drawer, whatever works for you, but have other sources of that information, and even an additional device. They're really affordable.
But even that, you don't have full control over. I had a contact list on one of my previous phones. It was perfect. You know, people I knew, my friends. And then one day, I guess it was the phone manufacturer decided it was a good idea to simply assume everybody that I followed on Twitter was a contact and merged it with my contacts. And to this day, I can't get rid of all the people that I follow on Twitter and have you know, a separate list of contacts. Yep. They can really screw things up if you're not careful.
I've had the same experience.
Yeah.
So again, like you said, be very closely guarding your ability to control that stuff, and be very deliberate about which and where and how you're accessing it. Because if you're, you know, thoughtful and you put something together, a system that works, you can actually make it a really tricky problem for someone to try to victimize you in any of these ways.
The other thing, separate yourself from your phone, you know? Don't have your phone by your bed, you know? Don't let it wake you up in the middle of the night. Turn your phone off, or just put it someplace else, or put it in silent mode and have hours to yourself. So many people don't do that. And that is the cause of stress. That is the cause of, you know, just so much people at work think they can just contact you anytime, or somebody sends it. I've pissed people off by sending a message while they were sleeping. And I don't think, even email, I don't think I'm waking somebody up if I'm typing on a terminal and sending a message. But I am, because people, every time there's an alert of any sort, a new message, they have to know immediately. That's not a healthy way to live.
I just want to say, I think, you know, on that very subject, if I recall correctly, at page 52 of volume 40 of 2600, there is an excellent article about this very subject of disconnection.
Would that be your article, Alex?
I think you might be right about that. I think you might be right about that, Emmanuel.
All right. Yeah. I would have bet everything I owned on that. But but yeah, no, it is a very good column that you write on in every issue. But tell us what's in this one.
Well, this one is about I wrote it when I was in room 5 of the Chelsea Arts Club in London.
Oh, now they're never going to be able to rent that room again. It's going to be on, there's going to be a waiting list for people to get into the room you were in.
Yeah, well, it's hard to get into that room anyway, right? Because you have to be a member of the club in order to stay there. So it's it's a little bit tough. But so the Chelsea Arts Club is this really interesting, wonderful, bohemian, chic kind of place in Chelsea, in London. I've done the show numerous times from there now, and it's a private members club that consists mostly of artists and writers and sculptors and visual artists. I'm proud to say there are almost no lawyers there.
Be careful of sculptors, by the way. Sculptors are a nasty bunch.
Yeah, they can be. Yeah. They can be. You know, they often have chisels and things too. So,
a poor sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah, oh, absolutely. Mm. Very funny.
Say the wrong thing and, well, never mind.
But anyway, one of the best things about the Chelsea Arts Club is that when you're inside, there's only one rule. Unlike a lot of the stuffy gentlemen's clubs of London where there are these fancy dress codes and you know, you have to wear a tie every time you take a piss or something. But, at the Chelsea Arts Club, there's no dress code whatsoever, and there's only one rule. And the rule is that you're not allowed to use a mobile device, a cell phone, any kind of electronic device while you're in the club.
And you have already said that you've done the radio show from the club using an electronic device, so perhaps you could explain to our listeners how you bypass their rules.
If you have a room inside
room five,
the club, you're staying in the club, you know, you can be in your bedroom and you can be using a device, but not when you're amongst other people in the club. I mean, presumably if somebody else is in your room with you, you can use your phone, of course, but if you're at the bar, if you're at the dining area, if you're in the back garden, anywhere else in the club, you are not allowed to use your phone, and it's kind of wonderful. The breakfast table there is this legendary place. You sit at this huge table in the dining area, and you sit down, and there's all the newspapers that are laid out. People come into the dining area, sit down next to you, and you just start talking. You know, you talk about what's going on in the world. What are you reading? What do you have going on in your day to day? People just strike up conversation with each other, and nobody is staring at their phone. It just never comes out of their pockets. Most people don't even have their phones on them.
Can I ask, not to be a wise guy or anything like that, but does the bartender have a phone in case there's a delivery in the back or something?
The bartender probably has a phone on him or her.
Uh-huh.
And if there is, some urgent need to go and check your phone, you can go into the lobby area right where you come in. Into the club, you're allowed to use your phone right there, to call an Uber or something like that. But anywhere else,
Bartender doesn't go to the lobby to answer a call from a delivery driver, does he? I mean, you can do that because he can't just leave it unattended.
Maybe, but I don't think the bartender would be getting calls from the delivery driver. You'd have the people at reception probably handling that anyway.
Well, are they going to shout to him? Oh, by the way, there's a delivery, or are they going to call him on the internal system?
Well, they would probably just walk through the one door that you need to get to the bar from reception.
I'm actually collecting a lot of information from what you're telling me, but okay, that's good to know.
I'm sure you are.
Now I know how to make a delivery to the place.
Very good.
So, yes, this is part of Alex's regular column that is in 2600. And by the way, Alex, you mentioned to great disruption at the beginning of the show that it was our 40th anniversary. And 40 years, and I was doing some math throughout the hour, and I realized it's not really true, because we put out our first issue in January of 1984, and this is now May of 2023, and 40 years would be 2024, not 2023. So the mistake you made was assuming that volume 40 meant 40 years. We're in the 40th, we're starting the 40th year, but we haven't done it for 40 years yet. You see the difference?
Well, the other mistake I may have made then would be trusting the cover of the magazine that says 40 years of dedicated service, progress of a sort.
But then yet another mistake that you made was assuming that that was referring to the magazine. 40 years of service could be the local mechanic who I want to congratulate for doing what he's done for so long. Yeah, but it is our 40th anniversary, all kidding aside.
But all year long.
Yeah, all year long. But then the real 40th anniversary would be next January.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to do anything next January for this real 40th anniversary as opposed to 40th?
I'd like to save it for the 50th, to be honest. That's the big one. Yeah.
Well, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have a party at 40 and a party at 50.
You say that now, but when the 50th comes up, you'll say, oh, man, I don't have the energy to, you know, do this yet again. And you had a party 10 years ago, so maybe you should just, you know, be thankful for what you got. I've had this conversation so many times, and
counterpoint to that, though, is, you know, and not to be too somber about it, but there are people that are here now that and will be here next year that won't be here 10 years from now. And I think of, in particular, of our friend Jim, to whom we had to say goodbye this year.
That's right. You know,
these things happen, and life is a series of happy memories, and you got to try to make those.
Well, it's more likely I'll drive them away, and that's why they won't be here. But yes, you do have to embrace the time that you have. Absolutely.
Well, we know Rebel would come.
Just tell us which CO they rented out.
We don't need a party. We don't. Okay. I want to share one more article, and then we can maybe open up phones. But in keeping with this whole, you don't own your technology, you don't own your data. I was reading, thegamer.com. I know we probably all read that at some point. The headline here is, what Jedi Survivor is doing with physical copies should be illegal. Yeah. I want you to hear what's going on here. Pretty soon, we're going to have to stop using the term physical copy to refer to the boxes you buy at the store with pictures of video games on the front. When you pick up a plastic case with a PS5 logo and the title of a video game on the front, pay GameStop $70 and take it home, you may think that what you just did was buy a physical copy of a video game. But when you crack open the case and pop out the disc, and yes, there is a disc, you basically think you're holding a video game that you now own, tangible, permanent copy of a game pressed onto a Blu-ray disc that now belongs to you forever. Unfortunately, if the disc you're holding says Star Wars Jedi Survivor on it, you'd be dead wrong. It turns out the physical version of Jedi Survivor does not actually contain the game, at least not all of it. Early copies of the game hit store shelves in New Zealand last weekend, and fans on Reddit noticed some tiny, easy-to-miss fine print on the front of the box that says download required. Apparently, after you insert the disc and install it to your system, you can only play through the intro mission before you're prompted to download the rest of the game. If for whatever reason you're unable to do that, then the disc, disguised as a video game you just bought, is useless. And this is not the first game to play this to pull this crap. Just another example in a worrying trend over the last few years. And I think it's something we're going to be seeing more and more of. Basically, even when you buy a physical copy, you're not actually getting a physical copy. You're getting part of it, and you have to go online to get the rest. And you know, this particular article says you can download the rest of the game. I think it'll get more to the point where you can't download the game. You have to be connected at all times in order to play the game. And the disc just enables you to start that process. And the time will come when we simply can't have anything tangible. You just have to always be connected to something else. And I think that's a very worrying trend. And I'd like to suggest people just not be connected at all. In fact, only get things that work when you're not connected to the internet. Assume that we are not connected to the internet. What about people that can't afford to be connected to the internet? Do they not get to play video games now? Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been into video games for as long as there have been such a thing. And, I have cartridges in storage for the old Atari systems and Nintendo systems that if I dust one off and plug it into the console, it'll work exactly as it worked the day it was bought. And that's not something that you can really do anymore because pretty much every game, even physical games that you bought that were included on the disc, the first time you start them up, they'll download patches to fix all the bugs that they left on the game when it went into production because, you don't finish a game now anymore. You don't finish making a game before you sell it to people. But, this is bad for players. It's bad for preservationists. It's bad for outfits like the Internet Archive, where they have, for preservationist purposes, old games for, you know, computers that you can't get anymore, systems that you can't get anymore, and you could start these up on an emulator and play them. You're not going to be able to do that with this sort of thing. It's hobbling the player's ability to make use of what they're buying, and it hobbles the future's ability to go back and get this experience again.
Go ahead, Alex.
Well, one counterpoint here, though, is that there does seem to be a very reasonable and logical explanation for why a download is required and you don't have the entirety of the game on the disk. Is that I just looked this up, and according to the very highly accurate authority of Reddit, it does seem like the disks themselves can only hold about 50 gigs. And a lot of games are a lot larger now than 50 gigs. And I presume that this Jedi game is one of them, and that's probably why a download is required. So I guess they're making a choice between having the game come with two discs, which I guess from a production standpoint would get tricky because you would have to have a different case, and you know that all gets expensive pretty quickly, and just making people download things.
Yeah, when CD-ROMs were new, I bought games on CD that came with two discs, three discs. I think the biggest one that I had was a game called Phantasmagoria, which came on seven CDs, and that was in the early days of CD-ROMs, and they managed. And I can still take those seven CDs, and if I have a computer running a copy of Windows that will run it, I can still access and play that game, and I won't be missing any features of it.
Can I just point out that there's such a thing called Ultra HD Blu-ray? That's been out since, 2017? And that can hold 100 gigs. So I don't accept that excuse. I don't. There's always something else that can be developed that will hold more data.
Well, that's true, but you would need the drive itself to be able to read that.
And that's something else they can sell to the public. You know, yet another bit of hardware.
But you would have to have that with a brand new console. I think any time you have a new console coming out, when there's a PlayStation 6, I would hope that they would do that, though, Manuel.
There is a PlayStation 6.
Yeah, there is a PlayStation 6.
2027.
Try to keep up, Alex. Come on.
Oh, all right.
Ask your kid. He can update you.
Yes, you're right. No doubt. Are we going to do some phone calls?
Yes, let's open up the phone lines. 802-321-4225 is our phone number.
802-321-HACK. All night about software as a subscription.
Yeah, and video games. You know, the last time I played a video game, I don't even remember.
I'm in the real video game.
I like the video games where it's not all about shooting. You know, does anybody play those games? I would like a game. People might not think this is fun. I'd like a game where I got in a car and drove somewhere. I would like that game. You know, kind of like you've been playing with Google Earth lately, Kyle.
Oh yeah, I've been
kind of like that, except fun.
Marking all the underground bunkers and like how they're like being built over time in Russia and China. It's hilarious.
I'm surprised you can find
them. I like the video games where you have like a timeline and you can put down your video and then you can make edits and you can do transitions and stuff.
I like Blade Runner. That was a good game. I liked Road Rash. That was a good game. I liked Lode Runner. I liked Adventure. That was a text game.
Shall we take a call?
Do we have a call?
No. Oh, we do now.
We do now. Yes, let's take a call then. All right, and we have a call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime.
Hello?
Am yes, you are on the air or on the net anyway.
Oh, cool. I just want to ask a question. I rented a car a couple months ago, and I like to play with the radio on it. I hook up my phone, but when I return the car, I delete my phone information. But what I did notice was that some people don't.
Uh-huh.
And at one day, I noticed that there were actually phone numbers left in the car's memory, in the phone's memory, with the person's name.
Oh boy!
And it's like it was interesting. I mean, I'm just wondering, like, is that common?
It's very common.
Yeah,
very
there's common. There's sync settings with Bluetooth association, so people associate their phone maybe in a rental or something, and then maybe hit a button where it's syncing contacts and stuff like that that they don't necessarily think through.
They forget to wipe it at the end, and then people come along and they can see all their contacts. They can even see where they went on GPS. It's I think the rental company is obligated to wipe this information if the user doesn't, because they're the ones giving it to somebody else afterwards.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm so curious. So I took pictures of them, but the phone numbers are right there in on the screen with, you know, it's some of the, you know, some of them had like username was like, you know, the phone's name or something, but there were other person's name on it. It was just weird.
Uh-huh. No, it's you're very observant for finding that. Go ahead, Alex.
You know, add to that this crazy notion that when people get the contract, when they're renting a car, which also is essentially their registration, that they need to hand over to a cop in case they get pulled over. And so, you know, they do this nutty thing with it. They fold it up and they put it in the glove compartment. And then lo and behold, they forget to take it out when they return the car. And then imagine this crazy idea that, you know, the people cleaning the car don't clean the glove compartment. You know, and you can find those very pieces of paper that may also have their name on it, their address, some payment history information, as well as very often a photocopy of their license.
Oh boy!
That goes together with, you know, in addition to those contacts, you may be able to tie those contacts to a person and have a copy of their ID if they weren't careful. I literally have seen this happen in a rental that Volkswagen gave me while I was having my car repaired for something with the bumper. So I couldn't believe it when I saw that.
This is a great Law and Order script, I think. Yeah, I really do, because you know, imagine that a crime was committed and the evidence is right there on the Bluetooth Echo, whatever you want to call it, that's still in the car's system, and somebody just has to track it down.
Oh, you know, and another question I have related to that is that, you know, if you delete your phone, is it fully, like, is it completely deleted? Is the information gone completely?
You can never really be sure. You know?
Sort of.
You want to think it is, but it's a good question, is it?
Yeah, overwriting memory on solid state, like integrated circuits, is not necessarily, like, as thorough as it might seem, and to technically know or to verify a lot of that, it takes a little bit, I think, more than just like the average click. I think what you would do is err on the side of caution. And if you really want to know that there's no information on something, you kind of need to destroy it.
There might be apps out there that claim to do this, but I don't know if they're trustable.
How about disconnecting the battery? I mean, I don't know how much, modern cars, but
there's been proof of concept, at least in computer system memory, like in RAM, like cold boot situations. That's old stuff though. Like with phones and SD solid state memory, it's not as clear cut as just pulling a battery. As much as we would like to think it's storing information before it loses power, and that information still resides. There's many different types of memory within the board that is a smartphone. That's my guess.
To the battery, like the car's battery, like if you just want to make sure that everything's erased.
oh, you're talking about the car. That could work. That might pull some of the information, but you got to disconnect it and reconnect it. I thought you meant the phone, but that's a good idea.
No, try that.
Yeah.
I thought you meant the phone too.
The vehicle. Yeah, totally. You could probably reset what numbers are stored by disconnecting the battery. That's a great idea.
Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I think the only way you can be completely sure that you haven't left a piece of information in the car's computer is not to let it get there in the first place. You know, if you want to pair up your Bluetooth just for audio, make sure you select the option on your phone when the notification pops up, you know, don't share your contact list. Don't share your GPS and all that.
Yeah. Watch those menus.
If you never tell the car's computer what, you know, Uncle Beppy and Aunt Myrtle's phone number is, then the car's computer will not know.
Now I'm wondering should I call these people and just let them, like, warn them for the
you
next
know,
time?
I found when you do that, people generally aren't as appreciative as you might expect. They look on you with great suspicion and think that you're up to something. But you know, if you have a chance to, what you're doing right now is very good. You're warning a lot of people and probably preventing this from happening in the future.
Yeah.
I maybe tell the car rental company, hey, you might have a problem here. People are leaving their private data around, and they could be held responsible, maybe.
Okay, cool.
All right. Wait, where are you calling from?
The Bronx.
Cool. Well, thank you for listening.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Take care. 802-321-4225 is our phone. That was a good call. It's something that's definitely on my mind. I've noticed that in rental cars.
It's happened to me. I've had that feeling. You're all of a sudden trying to do something, and then like
you're not quite sure what you're agreeing to. And you have to either like give it a go and let it or refuse it and not have that feature work.
It's just, you know, to do this, you have to answer a question on your phone and on the car saying, do you want to transfer this information from your phone to the car? Right there, that should fill you with trepidation, you know? Do you really want your private info or your contacts to be, I mean, it's convenient, but how hard is it to just use your phone, you know, or maybe not use your phone while you're driving?
Great argument for a travel phone or a phone that's prepaid or something that is just not associated with you so that, yeah, you can avail yourself of these amenities, but not be diving into it with something so tightly or closely associated with
it. Yeah, go old school, you know, put your phone in speaker mode, dial a number, talk while you drive that way.
Yeah, get the earpiece, mm-hmm. the Bluetooth for your ear, yeah.
You hear cars are bringing, or at least Volkswagen's bringing buttons back. Because touch screens, who knew, they can be hazardous while you're driving to look at a screen and select options, whereas buttons you can feel and just press while you're looking straight ahead. Imagine, we're learning so much. Nobody knew that before. So now some cars are bringing buttons back. I didn't know buttons were gone because I tend to drive cars that have buttons in them. And knobs, too, sometimes. I like knobs, you know?
Knobs can be great, but the last time we rented a car, we rented a minivan in the Midwest, and the gear shift was a knob, and I'd never seen that before, but it was a knob on the dashboard right next to the volume for the radio. So you could, if you were just feeling your way and you wanted to turn the radio up and down, you could have accidentally shifted yourself into reverse or something.
It did seem like an accident waiting to happen.
Wow. So the shifting was actually a knob. That's yes. Kind of interesting. I didn't know they did that.
It was a minivan from, I think, last year? Or?
It was a pretty newish model minivan. It was a tank.
Uh-huh.
It was seriously a tank.
It's weird how every car manufacturer seems to have its own ideas as to where to put certain buttons and features and knobs and whatever else. And there's, you know, there are very few standards. Like the steering wheel, generally in the same place, same shape. Okay, we agree on that.
For now.
But windshield wiper, good luck. Could be on the right, could be on the left, could be a button, could be a knob, could be a dial, could be a selection on a screen somewhere.
Even if you pick a favorite model, you know, they might move it around from year to year.
So. Mm-hmm. It's true. So, buttons might be coming back. That's good news. Any calls?
I like that. No, not yet. Maybe give the number out. But
802-321-4225.
Less screens in things moving at a high velocity. No call yet.
Wow, we've run out of things to say.
That line still open.
How about this? I have something interesting we can do if you guys are into it. I got one of these fraudulent purchase orders from Geek Squad today, and I could call the fraudulent 800 number associated with it if we're interested. See how the scam works.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, hold on a sec. Let's see if we can get this thing going. Hopefully, I haven't called this because they often blacklist your number.
Okay.
So let's see if we can. Okay, dial. All right, can you hear that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The number you have dialed is not in service.
Whoa, that is something, Alex.
Wow, it's out already, huh? Damn. Wait, hold on. Let's try that one more time. Going to hear the DTMFs here?
Yes, we do.
We hear the DTMFs. We're trying not to decode them. I think Rebel already has decoded them, though.
The number you have dialed is not in service.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow, you found another one. How did you do that?
Yeah, all right. Well, I guess that's not going to work then. Yeah. I saved it, you know, because I thought it would be fun to dial. But
This is where we test things before the show.
Well, I didn't want to test it because it could have realized that I wasn't a legitimate victim and then blacklisted my number. So,
and yet it did that anyway.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
We're going to give it one more minute, 802-321-4225. If anyone out there would like to go. Did we only get one call tonight?
Yeah.
Wow. We have a fair amount of listeners, so I don't understand that. And we are on YouTube, right? We've verified that. Good. Good.
Yeah, people are watching. We sound good on YouTube.
You know what it is? If we're preempted, that sometimes people forget that we're on. But I just said we have a usual number of listeners, so maybe there's just nothing to talk about.
I disagree.
Well, we're certainly proving that here.
No, we're not.
Maybe we're all talked out.
I'm trying to find more Geek Squad.
I'll just, while we're waiting, remind people again that the 2600 meetings are happening all over the world this Friday. You can go to 2600.com/meetings to find one near you or start one near you. Our local one is at the building on 53rd and Lexington in their food court, which is called The Hue. This used to be the Citigroup building. Now it's, I think, called something else.
Wait, it's not called the Citigroup building anymore?
I think they stopped calling it that at some point. I might be wrong about that. But the food court itself has a name, and that name is Hue.
Hue. Okay. And
yes.
How do you spell Hue?
H-U-G-H. It's actually The Hue, so the definite article, you might say.
Okay. Okay, well, we do have a call, so I'm going to say hello to the person on the air. Good evening.
Oh, hi. Am I on?
You are on. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I thought the theme that you had on the radio part of the show was very interesting, and I'm going to define it as a technology substituting and enforcing the laws of the state, or making even new laws that it is enforcing on behalf of the state. How do you like that?
Sounds good.
Well, I'm going to tell you a personal experience I've had. Are you familiar with WePay, which is part of Chase Bank?
Mm-hmm.
Do you use it? Have you ever used it?
I don't think I've used it. I know about it.
Okay. Well, I entertained this offer. I'm a client of Chase for a long time. I have a business account, and they offered me the WePay. Well, it's not the WePay machine, but it turned out to be connected to WePay with an enticement of $400 after a certain amount of transactions were processed. And I decided to go for it. I had already had another similar offer in years before with Chase, then, you know, with no problems. And to make the story short, I, at the fourth transaction, my account was terminated, and I was told that I was a high risk of chargebacks and disputes. Without any evidence of this, 20 years of relationship with the bank, not a bounce check, no nothing. The transaction sailed smoothly, and suddenly I ran afoul of some artificial intelligence algorithm that decided that I am not a worthy client. And this happened a month ago. They seized the money for my transaction. Once I went online, I didn't do my due diligence before, because I had this kind of thing happen before with Chase and everything was fine. And I found thousands of complaints. Apparently this WePay is a really bad actor. And I even contacted a class action law firm in California that is looking into the opportunity to basically sue the hell out of them. Uh-huh. But meanwhile, I'm still in limbo. My money is not going to be the original message. They said they were holding on for a minimum of 30 days, now 120 days. I didn't get as much as a phone call. They didn't talk to the counterpart, who was perfectly happy with the way the transactions had been processed. And here I am talking to you about it.
Wow. That's not, they actually have money of yours?
Yes. Almost $500.
It doesn't seem legal that they can just hold it like that. And you say it's been 120 days?
No, they are. They say that they're going to hold it for, first they say the minimum of 30 days. And in a later message, denying my appeal, I had to go through all kinds of hoops. I'm thinking of even just going, in the latest message they said it was going to be a minimum of 120 days. So I'm even thinking of starting with small claims here before the class action happens, if it happens, because, you know, my point of contention is that I walked into a branch, a local branch in New York City, Manhattan, and I responded to this offer that had been made to me. And so I think, you know, even the small claims in your county may have something to say about this, and that's when I plan to start. But just to say, you know, this is not Big Brother, this is Big Cyborg, and it's just unbelievable. You know, you can be a good citizen, dotting all the T's,
right?
No, you dot the I's and you cross the T's, and suddenly you find yourself out in the cold for apparently no reason.
There are a number of things you can do, and bad publicity is what they fear the most. So going to a local elected official of your choice and getting them on your side, that's one way to go. Going to a TV station that has a news program where they, you know, point the finger at corrupt businesses and things like that. Get something like that. They'll respond quickly, but there are a number of options. Thing is, though, a lot of people will have similar stories. You said there are thousands of complaints, so
yes,
definitely this will resonate.
If you go on Google and you Google, you know, we pay class action suit,
mm-hmm.
you'll find lots of, you know, Better Business Bureau sites with literally thousands of complaints about this company acting in a similar manner.
Wow. Well, yeah, don't be quiet about this.
Speaking out. You know, I plan to get some blood for real, and I really hope that this firm is going to go for a class action suit, because that's the only thing that might correct their behavior. You know, it's when they start losing millions of dollars that then they say, oh, perhaps we should change something.
Well, what do you think their motivation in behaving this way is, or is it something that they're not in control of?
Well, you know, it's hard to make theories, but I have, of course. Apparently, Chase has bought this company for $400 million a few years back. I wonder, you know, as I say, there are plenty of complaints. I'm not the first one. So I really don't know what their motivation is, but it may be. I had read a checkout on my Hotmail account. I didn't read the full article because often, you know, the things that appear are not reliable. But I had seen a few times that Chase was getting out of retail banking, and perhaps this is a sneaky way they're doing this. You know, they're pissing customers off.
That's one way to get out of retail banking.
Enough money with.
Wow.
Yeah, they think, oh, we're not making enough money with this guy. You know, he always gets our $400 offer, and we never get any fees from him. And, you know, he just keeps the minimum inside the account.
So you're using their system to your advantage, and they resent that.
Yes, that's exactly, yeah, that's what I think may be going on. But, of course, I have no proof of that other than, you know, finding myself out in the cold for apparently no reason.
Definitely an interesting story. Skype folks, do you have any input on this?
I'm looking at some of the reviews online right now, and a lot of people are saying this is happening to them, that payments are being held. And what's interesting is someone from WePay went through on the Better Business Bureau site and is responding to every complaint saying, we're so sorry to hear that you feel that way.
Yeah, that's what they keep telling me, yes. And meanwhile, they're saying, we're so sorry that we cannot reinstate your account, you know, that you're going to have to find different solutions, which, of course, you know, it's crap. But.
Well, I mean, the important thing is getting your money back. And I don't think you would want to work with them anymore anyway.
And, you know, in my demand for, you know, I added it up. It's the $450 plus the cost of the machine plus. The offer that they, I said, you know, I want $1,201, and I also want you to erase and make inaccessible any information that would be damaging to my capability, to my reputation, to my credit rating, to my capability to conduct business. And that's what I want in court more than anything else, because it's not just the money. You know, you end up in obscure databases that companies that process credit cards exchange, and you're suddenly a criminal.
Well, just blacklisted
nobody
in there.
Nobody will ever give you, you know, the capability of processing payments again.
Right. Now you're blacklisted in their database, like yes. The landlord database, if you get in some of these bad. But Alex, any legal advice you can offer? Can they just take them to small claims court? Do they have to answer?
Well, yeah, you could. I mean, you could sue in small claims court. There's any number of legal remedies available here. I think you know, small claims court has a damages limit, though. You know, so I think if it's over $5,000, it depends on the county, right? I think, but I think it might be a $5,000 or $10,000 limit to go into small claims court. But this does seem like the type of thing where you know, a class action would be the mechanism that could go forward, because if, you know, it's one thing if you wrong one person, it's just not worth the, you know, pursuing for, you know, $100 or $200 or something like that. But, you know, if you wrong a massive amount of people for a small amount of money, that's the mechanism that a class action is seeking to. Well, that's the legal situation for which the class action is an appropriate mechanism. So.
Well, Alex, would you be interested in taking on something like this?
Probably not. I just think
Alex is in demand. He's booked.
Yeah, I don't really do class action law, you know. And to be honest, on most of these, we would be. My firm is a pretty big firm. We'd probably be defending class action rather than pursuing it.
So you might see him in court after all, on the other side.
Yeah. You never know. That's why I'm dancing around the issue, because I really don't know if the parent company could be a client. So I don't want to make any statements about, you know, the merits of it or not. I'll just talk about the legal remedy itself.
You know, after my DECSS lawsuit, I saw my lawyer in a future case on the side that I was not on. And I said, oh, my God, how could you do that? But that's, you know, lawyers do that. They wind up on different sides sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't really count on it.
Yeah, that's the, you know, the long and the short of it. You had a great lawyer, though, for the DECSS case. You must have been talking about Marty Garbus.
I didn't want to drop names, but yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the nature of the game that legal people wind up defending other people.
Oh, no. It wasn't a suggestion for my case.
There definitely is a case, and I think connecting with other people is definitely a good step. But also the advice we offered as far as contacting media apart from us, politicians would be very interesting. The right politician could definitely open some doors here. Again, the company doesn't want bad publicity, and if you can bring that to them, they'll give you whatever you're asking for.
Okay, good advice. I'll keep you posted in future shows.
Yes, please do.
Hopefully, I'll be able to fend for myself in this in this matter.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank
keep
you.
Keep up the good work.
Take care.
All the best.
You know, that reminds me. My judge was in the news. He was trending on Twitter. You know, the Judge Kaplan?
Why? What did he do recently? I mean, he's got so many interesting cases.
It's just kind of weird because, you know, I see my judge from the DECSS case in 2000 trending on Twitter. I'm like, I feel this sense of pride. Like, hey, that's my judge. It's like, why do I feel a sense of pride for the guy who ruled against me? But, yeah. You know, I felt like, you know, some sort of a representation there.
Yeah, save that for when he's not ruling.
Well, it was my judge, okay? When your judge is trending on Twitter, you'll understand. But, yeah, Lewis Kaplan ruled against Trump this week for something. I don't know. There's so many rulings against Trump in 1 week. I don't know which one this was, but the case that he's presiding over.
He also has the FTX case with SBF, so it's a big one.
Wow. All right. My call tonight, it's 9 o'clock.
I think we can take one more call. If there's a call, I say we take it.
Then I say you get the call.
Oh boy.
Fetch it.
You work for this, Alex. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try. But, you know, we need people to call. I know there's burning questions on people's minds. You might want to talk about AI, digital footprints, all kinds of issues and things. But if they don't call, they won't have their questions answered.
Phone lines are still open. No calls yet. Keep going, Alex.
802-325-4222.
Get the phone number right, for God's sake. Well, the phone's ringing, so you know you blew it anyway.
There
but it's go. It's 802. Now you got me saying it wrong. 802-321-4225. It doesn't matter, though. It's going to be busy now. Good evening. You're on Off Talk Overtime. Go ahead.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you fine. Where are you calling from?
Calling from Kansas.
Okay, you're the Kansas guy.
Yeah, I didn't want to be rude and call on two subsequent weeks, but since you were asking for calls, something was on my mind.
That is so considerate. If only everybody followed the same decorum that you do and didn't call every week or every other call or whatever. Sometimes, you know, people are a bit intense. But
truth be told, we don't have a rule.
We don't have a rule, but we appreciate the consideration.
True, but it's a consideration,
yes. And,
you know, the precedent should be set. So
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share with you guys all the, I guess, this is the fatigue that comes from Twitter, all the conversations around that.
Oh, yeah.
We're hackers. I feel like we should drive away from that space, right? Like, I think you should put the call out or maybe just hackers in general, right? Like, let's take back IRC. Let's let's go to the 2600.com website. Let's find other places and not reward, you know, sort of this circus and this media and this frenzy. It's really just something to talk about and just sort of feeds into all of that craziness. And that was, you know, sort of something that we've been talking about a lot is, again, just minimize the craziness, minimize all the nonsense in the world. And the most powerful thing we can do is our actions. And so if we move away from those platforms, again, whether it's because we, you know, have whatever the nature of our disagreement is, and we'll frame it under the umbrella of Twitter. But if we move away from those things and find alternate solutions, that's really the hacker spirit and the mentality of things. Like, when something isn't working, let's take it back and put the call out to our friends and our colleagues and things and drive them to other platforms.
Yeah, that makes sense. I agree with that. But somebody winds up running it. And whenever that happens, eventually they go down the wrong path and piss people off. And then you have the same thing happening all over again. You have, you know, who decides what the next thing will be, you know, and why do they get to decide that? Is it because of who they are, where they are, what they work for? There are going to be people who disagree with that. Then you have five different things people can go to. And it's weird. You can't predict what's going to
concede. It does fragment, right? Mm-hmm. The voices and things like that. It makes it harder to hear the signal and the noise, but even right now, with as overrun as again Twitter is, with just so much nonsense, and you can't really follow the things that you're interested in, and it's broken up the sort of the communities and things like that. And I guess we'll open the door if you don't mind for a moment. What do you guys think about Mastodon? I mean, there are some things out there. It's the idea of decentralized. Nobody
right.
can sort of take over and claim ownership of it. Have you guys?
I was gonna ask about Mastodon if you had an opinion about that, because that is what many people have gravitated towards. Decentralized, networked. I think it's gotten better in the last few months because the things that I post show up faster in different places. I'm not seeing a lot of people embracing it, like as many as I would hope for. I'd like to see more.
Certainly not mainstream, right? I think a lot of the early adopters, right? Because there's always the early adopters to the platform. They're going to be the ones that sort of get it in people's minds, right? You've got to sort of break through that barrier. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you guys on the radio with your presence in the hacker community, I think you really could sort of encourage people, or again, just open up the discourse. I'm certainly not lobbying for one thing over the other, but you guys have the ability to reach a lot of people. And so, again, let's drive people to solutions that aren't necessarily where we give up all of the control of our data to, or we give up all of our posts and we don't own them. Like, let's find a better solution. So,
consider, I would say, I mean, I'm with you on this, and I think it's a good idea, but consider there's been the outcry and the options, and we did early on discuss alternatives and, you know, put out there that there are places people are migrating to. But consider that there's been this much activity moving away and discuss and moving towards alternatives without any emphasis. We've merely just discussed what people are doing, what options are. There is no campaign. And as E explained, having the wisdom of seeing stuff like this happen in different organizations before, yeah, I mean, it isn't a campaign, and there are pitfalls in trying to coalesce around something like that. But consider, yeah, what were people to put emphasis on that? It's certainly an option in the future, and were they to do that, I think that even if it was a temporary campaign, I think it could certainly have an impact.
I think the most important thing here is being able to network, because when you isolate, that's when things get weaker. IRC is a perfect example of this. Back when it was FNet and Dialnet and big networks like that, almost everybody was on them. You could reach all these different people. But then we started having fragmentation. Even within the 2600 IRC network, people in a particular part of the country would say, okay, now we're going to run our own IRC network, but you couldn't reach it on the main network. You had to go to their server to be on their IRC network. And of course, there are only about 8 people on there. And we've seen the same thing happen with instant messaging, and now even with email and various other ways of communicating. I like what Mastodon does as far as networking different servers and different parts of the world together, but it's not centralized, and I think that is, you know, something like that is the solution. But it has to be easy to use, and we might be able to figure it out. But if you know, I hate to keep bringing grandparents into this, but if your grandparents can't figure out how to use it, it's probably too difficult for the average person who's not technically inclined. And, you know, if you want something truly usable for communications, you do need to have it be somewhat easy to use or intuitive.
Sure. I guess the only counterpoint that I might add to that, though, is how much value do we get because Twitter is as accessible as it is? I mean, outside of the tech community, I could see we could make the argument for people that are, you know, skilled professionals sharing information. The challenge, though, is there's just so much of social media that's really just wasted hard drive space. I mean, I remember on a show in the past, you guys were talking about, like, you really wanted to have 2600 on Instagram, for instance, right? I guess I would sort of make a little bit of a judgmental call that not every picture on Instagram has merit, right? You know, there is a lot of sort of wasted bandwidth for those things. And if there were a bit more of a difficult barrier to entry, is there the possibility of reducing the noise, right? And so that's a debatable thing. You know,
well,
again,
the barrier,
judgment of other people's
the
content.
Barrier to our entry so, is just our name. They don't like our name. And I'm sorry, but we can't yield on our name. 2600, they say you can't use all numbers, but there are accounts that use all numbers, so that's a load of crap. So we're not on Instagram because of that.
It's probably disingenuous.
Yeah. We've run into that many, many times.
We can't forget the noise of ads too. I mean, just the advantage of finding a way to move away from that, to get away from the commercial side of this form of spreading information in ads, that would be a huge benefit. But the will has to be there, and the overarching structure has to facilitate it.
Well, you raised a good point, which is we have to. Oh, I'm sorry, Rob.
Yeah. Rob, your hand is off camera. Yeah. I can't. Oh. You're raising your hand. It's off camera, so I don't see it. Sorry.
He's raising
it. It's on camera for me, but I guess it's off the edge of the screen. You have me squashed. But anyway, to go back to what you were asking about Mastodon, like, I personally love Mastodon so much. It's become my social media daily driver. And I know so many of the people who I know personally, and maybe this just speaks to my personal circles, but so many of the people I know who have lessened or stopped using Twitter and moved to Mastodon are people in the hacker community. The hacker community seems to really be strongly embracing Mastodon in particular, but also in general, the federated social media, the decentralized stuff like Mastodon, the other ActivityPub stuff, because it's like how the internet itself works, where it routes around damage. No one entity controls it, and everyone just collaboratively keeps it going. And nobody can buy Mastodon in the way that someone bought Twitter and took it in all sorts of directions.
But Rob, can I ask you this? Those people that you don't see eye to eye with, those people that you disagree with on social issues, political issues, things like that, are they on Mastodon?
I'm sure they are, and I could find them if they wanted, or if they could find me if they wanted.
I feel like they're probably on Truth Social, if we're being honest.
Yeah, probably on Truth Social, a different system, and that's just segregation. Then you're not, I don't like idiots, but I recognize that idiots are a big part of the world. And sometimes you want to engage. If somebody says something particularly egregious, you either want to bring it to the attention of others, or you want to shoot them down in one way or another. And if you take that away and you're only with people that you get along with, well, eventually you're going to stop getting along with them too, but you're missing out on the potential for actual dialogue and disruption.
I will say there have been occasions on Mastodon where I have had discussions with people who've responded to something I said, or I responded to something they said, and there was a disagreement, there was a discussion, but that was it. It was a discussion. It wasn't like a flame war. It wasn't, calling people names and, saying terrible things about them. It was a discussion, because I think the general vibe on Mastodon is one of more reasonable human interaction than I think Twitter has grown into. And I'm digging
agree with
it.
Rob on that. It feels like the volume got turned back down. It really sort of has reset a lot of things. There's a lot better engagement on the platform. And I also, Rob, I put my money where my mouth is. I abandoned Twitter. I deleted my account and went over to Mastodon as well to really sort of, pitch in and really show that I was going to support an alternate choice in the space.
No, that's great. And if the volume is turned down and the discussions are more intelligent, that's amazing too. I'm just wary of that happening only within a certain perspective of people. And if it's only people that are fairly liberal, that are treating each other with respect, and people who are conservative just aren't around anymore, I don't think that's the solution. I'd like it to be everybody treating each other with more respect and disagreeing as much as ever, but doing it in a more civilized way. So hopefully we can achieve that.
This also speaks to the
point.
Go ahead, Rob.
I'm very sorry. This really speaks to just how the place of social media in all our lives has changed over the years since Twitter has been the big one. Because before that, like social media, you would find interest groups about things you were interested in. You would find sort of, forums around a single subject or things like that. And when Twitter became the thing everyone had, or Facebook's another one that became the thing everyone had, then you had to deal with everyone. And this whole situation has made me question sort of the place of social media in my own life. And like, do I want to interact with this fire hose of everybody, including the assholes? Or do I want to go back to a more comfortable place of like, hey, here's people who are interested in what I have to say. I can follow people who are interested in who I find interesting.
It's scope of community, like how big and what kind of control and modulation you have over that control.
Well, and I would say too, as the Emmanuel, to your point about the barriers to entry and getting additional voices in the space, the technology, I mean, I still feel it's early, and you pointed out that we haven't really been talking about it extensively. Mm-hmm. So it's going to mature. It'll become easier. And so eventually there's going to, you know, there's going to be a segment of Twitter people that will become, you know, exhausted from the circus and move as well. I mean, I think like that's all the technologies that, I guess, that have legs, right? That have any sort of longevity in them. They'll continue maturing. They'll become easier to use. And eventually will we be having this discussion again that this is the new Twitter 2.0 debacle where everything, the volume's too loud and we can't hear each other. It's possible because everything humans do tends to be circular, but that's a discussion for another time.
All right. It's ongoing for sure. And living through history. But thanks for the thoughts.
I don't want to take too much time. I know it's late. So again, thank you everybody for the show and take care and have a good evening.
Thank you for calling.
Yep. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Kansas, you got to have strength to survive in Kansas and, you know, be a freedom loving person. Actually, you know, Kansas has done some good things recently with certain votes, but there's also, well, the whole country is going through crap right now.
I feel like a conversation. It's so familiar. It's like you know, like a part of that community that Rob was talking about creating, and I feel like we're just picking up where we left off from week to week and trying to push some of these ideas forward to get to a place where people do have comfort, they have control, and they're empowered over and over again by these tools instead of the opposite.
I think that's pretty much going to do it for us tonight. We're going to try to connect to Pornhub on Utah's IPs. Right? We have to figure out how to defeat their systems and strike a blow for freedom. Any closing thoughts from people out there?
Go to the 2600 meetings.
That's right. Every first Friday of the month, and that's coming up this Friday, all around the world. 2600.com/meetings to see if there's one near you and to start your own.
Who's the first celebrity star that's going to show up on Mastodon? Is that what it's going to take? Like, Madonna,
it's
is she on Mastodon?
Is Madonna on Mastodon?
I don't know. You tell me.
Why should I tell you? Why should I care?
Who's a star? You know, like...
You know, in terms of celebrities, in terms of, like, mainstream celebrities, not just people dorks love.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But, like, went during the whole debacle last autumn with Twitter, and a lot of people emigrated to Mastodon. A lot of sort of big-name accounts did check it out. I know Kathy Griffin, the comedian, is on Mastodon now. You know, Neil Gaiman is on Mastodon.
But are they still participating? Did they just get an account then and forget about it?
That's a good question. I'll see if I can look this up.
The only reason I bring that up, really, is because the commercial social media sites, they often do this when there's a big buzz, when they're doing a publicity blitz. They try to get the right, you know, sports or some personality to attract the masses, and they do it for commercial gain and so forth, and getting that critical mass of people there.
You need that.
Does it have to be something so transactional? Maybe there is a willingness. It can be from hackers, as we're stating, but all kinds of communities could be attracted to this for really altruistic reasons. There are good reasons to move away from commercial stuff.
I mean, Rob, if you can tell when the last time Kathy Griffin tweeted on... Oh, wait, I can't use that word on there, can I?
It's Mastodon.
No, wait, they can't even... Be, oh, no. That's an unfortunate
prefix. Kathy
Griffin prefix.
Tooted?
Kathy Griffin last tooted on March 31st.
Oh, tooted is... I'm not accepting that.
Or you could say posted. Kathy Griffin, she put a thing about her latest show on there, and she responded to something someone else said.
Okay, all right, so there you go. It's being used.
We have a Mastodon account for the radio show. When's the last time we posted?
We do. We posted today. We post every week we're on the air, when we're on Off the Hook Overtime. I interacted with somebody via that. Somebody was trying to decide what to listen to, because apparently Overtime is on at the same time as another program. And, you know, they chose us, and I thank them for this.
Yeah, but there's a writer's strike now, and that affects a lot of other programs, and not us.
Yeah, but you know, we are on, at the moment, we are on Hacker Radio Show on Mastodon.social, if you use Mastodon and you would like to follow us.
Okay.
We should be the first show to follow there. When you join.
Yeah, I guess Off the Hook was taken, but fine. Write to us, OTH at 2600.com. We will be back next week on Off the Hook at 7 o'clock on BAI and 8 o'clock on Overtime right here on YouTube. Again, OTH at 2600.com. Meetings this Friday. Stay awake, stay with it, and fight back against all the crap that's out there, because there's an awful lot of it.